Well, thanks for the welcome, and thanks for the great lunch, everybody that contributed to that. Good stuff. Worth coming just for lunch. So our topic this afternoon is why, as a biologist, I believe in creation. And but I have to add a word in there, and that is why, as a Christian biologist, I believe in creation, because if I was not a Christian, if I was an atheist, I couldn't possibly believe in creation, could I? Because I wouldn't be an atheist then. So this goes, it's really about God. The whole thing is about God. It's not really about science, although they make it sound scientific, but it's not really about God. And of course, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And as this guy, William Provine, really nails what I've just said, he was at Cornell University, and he said, evolution is the greatest engine of atheism ever invented. And so what's evolution about? It's about atheism, about getting rid of God. And I naively, as a young Christian, tried to think that evolution was sort of God's way of making things, but that's not the case. It's actually how everything came to be without God. That's the whole point of evolution. In fact, you've talked to any of these well-known evolutionists, and you start talking about God used evolution, they'll look at you and say, what? You don't know what evolution is. Evolution is how everything came to be without God. That's the whole point of it. It's not God's way of doing things. And in fact, it's contrary to God's nature anyway, because it says that God created a world of death and suffering and struggle for survival right at the beginning, which of course is not the case. And so this billboard in America summarizes the reason for all this push for evolution, put up by the Freedom From Religion Foundation. That's the atheist club. They put up money to encourage people to believe in Darwin or evolution rather than God. And that's what it's about. Well, as someone who's done quite a few years of research on fruit trees, I'm rather chuffed by the fact that the first thing God created, first living things God created, were fruit trees. There it is in Genesis chapter 1, verses 11 and 12. God created fruit trees and all sorts of other plants, but fruit trees are the most important. Well, peas are pretty important too. And watermelons and pumpkins and things like that. But God created fruit trees and says they're producing fruit with seed in them after their kind. And this is a principle everybody that's involved in agriculture understands. And that is, when you plant a mango seed, you get another mango tree. Or if you plant a pea seed, you get a pea plant. If you plant a pumpkin seed, you get a pumpkin plant. You don't get something else. And the experiment's been done countless times. In fact, on the earth today, we have 8 billion people. So the experiment's been done 8 billion times with people, and every time a woman has given birth to a human baby. True? Yeah. True. And if it was otherwise, we'd be rather shocked. But the evolutionary story is that things change into other things. And so we see all sorts of varieties of people, for example. All sorts of varieties of frogs and different varieties of horses. In fact, zebras and donkeys can hybridise to produce a zedonk. Right? That shows that they are part of the same created kind. All sorts of varieties of dogs, all bred mostly in the last couple of 100 years. Enormous variety. You've got Chihuahuas through the Great Danes. I mean, aren't Chihuahuas really dogs? I'm not sure. But you know what I mean? All this variety of dogs. And they say, well, you can't see evolution happening today. It happens too slowly. Right? It happens too slowly. So you go to the fossils, go to the millions of years. It takes millions of years. So go to the fossils, you see evolution in action. Well, you actually don't. This is actually a diagram on the evolution of dinosaurs. And we have Paul Sereno here. He's considered an expert in the evolution of dinosaurs, asked by the editors of Science Journal, Science Magazine, to produce an article about the evolution of dinosaurs. So you would recognise some of these silhouettes up here, like T-Rex you might recognise, or Patasaurus, Brachiosaurus, or Stegosaurus. And we have down through this diagram shows the fossil record down through the rock layers of the different sorts of dinosaurs. So your Stegosaurus, for example, here's a black bar, represents a fossil evidence. And then we have this diagram down the bottom here. We've got dashed bars and open bars and dashed lines, all joining up into a big family tree and showing the common ancestor of all dinosaurs down here, how they all evolved from one creature down here, one type down here, evolved into all the different sorts of dinosaurs, and of course, lately, they're including birds in the story. So KFC should be KFD, Kentucky Fried Dinosaur. This is the latest fashion. Not all evolutionists agree with this, by the way, but you wouldn't know that from the media. So notice the open bars and the dashed lines are imagination. The only fossil evidence is the black bars, right? So let's colour in the imagination in red and blue. And then let's erase the imagination from the diagram. Hey, what happened with evolution? I'll take it back. I'm not making this up. This is actually... Go back to the beginning. This is the diagram. Colour in the imagination, which is not based on fossils. Erase the imagination. No evolution. The evolution's imagination applied to the evidence. Now, how many dinosaur fossils are there? Because they used to say... Oh, the reason we haven't found them is because we haven't found enough fossils yet. Do you get that story when you were doing... Yeah? We haven't found enough fossils yet, so we've got to keep looking to find them, and we'll find them. Well, there are 3,000 complete dinosaur fossils of these creatures. Not just parts. Estimated to be 100,000 bits. But 3,000 complete fossils of these dinosaurs... How many fossils of their ancestors there should be if their evolution is true? It should be thousands of them. How many are there? None. It's refutation. The big picture, the fossil, transitional fossils are missing. Something else the fossils show us, and that is that things don't change. They become extinct. Things have gone extinct. But they don't change. And you see that there with the diagram here. See, the bars go straight down through the rock layers like this. There's no drifting of one kind into another. Right? And you see this in what's called living fossils. Now, this is one of the more extreme living fossils. This is actually a sea pen or a soft coral. You see the hold fast there where it holds onto the rock. See the hold fast there? And this is supposedly 560 million years old, the fossil. And yet here's the one living today in the oceans today. Now, in 560 million years, almost all the evolution on Earth is supposed to have happened. You know, something's changed into worms. Worms have changed into all the creatures with a backbone, including us and dinosaurs and birds and fish. And everything with a backbone came from worms in this time frame. All the birds evolved. All the land plants evolved. Peas and pumpkins, all these things evolved. And yet, this thing, terribly boring, hasn't changed. Now, this is just one example. There are thousands of examples of things known in the fossil record, which we still have today. Things like jellyfish, starfish, brachiopods, coelacanth fish you might have heard of. There's thousands of them. We have extinction, we have things staying the same, we don't have any evidence of things changing to other things. Evolution is dead in the water, and there's no mechanism for it. And I'll talk about that in a minute. Stephen Gould and Niles Eldridge were at the American Museum of Natural History in New York in the United States, and they wrote this article called Punctuated Equilibrium Comes of Age, as a review of some of their ideas. But here's what they said. The maintenance of stability, things staying the same, within species must be considered as a major evolutionary problem. In other words, if the only evidence we have is things stay the same or much the same, some variety, size and shape and stuff, but some variety but much the same, it's got to be a major evolutionary problem, because what's evolution? But it's a change of one kind into another. And as I said in the first talk, this idea, once we were worms, it's the goo to you by way of the zoo idea. And in the schools and universities today, they're tricking students into believing evolution by saying things like, oh, evolution is just change in gene frequencies, or it's just change. You know, look up the dictionary, evolution just means change. Change over time. Well, I believe in change over time. Look at me, I'm getting older. Right? But that's not evolution. And this guy here is one of the famous evolutionists, actually called this. He said it's quite deceptive to say that, evolution is just change in gene frequencies, you know. And he said this, he said, I pointed out more than a decade ago, this is 1977, that the reductionist explanation so widely adopted in recent decades that evolution is just change in gene frequencies in populations is not only not explanatory, it is in fact misleading. And that's exactly what they're doing with or the way they're teaching evolution today. It's misleading. And I can illustrate why it's misleading. Because we can have a look at an example of natural selection. And another thing they're doing is saying, oh, natural selection is evolution. So natural selection is evolution. Well, let me show you why natural selection is not evolution. This is an example. There's a couple of friendly wolves. This was in Creation magazine. We have pairs of genes. Get one from your father, one from your mother. We got about 20,000 pairs of protein-coding genes. And one gene says here, in the wolf says make short hair, a pair of the two says make long hair. And we end up with a medium length hair wolf. And if you're a geneticist, they're codominant. If they're not, don't worry about it. But if year 10 in science, year 10 equivalent, you'll learn about genetics and about how genetics and in fact peas are famous because Mendel was a famous scientist in the 1800s. Worked on peas to work out the basics of genetics. And so the colour of the flowers and different things like that, he recognised were due to these unseen, invisible, inheritable traits, and they could pass from one generation to the next. And some of them could be hidden in the sense that they're recessive, so if you've got a dominant gene and a recessive gene together, the dominant gene sort of hides the effect of the recessive gene. And then the next generation, the two recessive genes might get together and the effect wasn't visible in this generation. And you see that with blue eyes. See, my parents both have brown eyes, so I've got blue eyes. And that's because they had the recessive gene for blue eyes, and I'm one of four that got blue eyes. So it's about approximately one in four would have blue eyes. So two of my brothers have brown eyes, the other one has blue eyes. So we've sort of got a bit more than the average, but on average it'll be one in four. So anyway, this is a gene where the genes work together and they make it co-dominant, or they work together for the effect. So you've got medium-length hair. Now, the way reproduction occurs, you can get a short hair gene, you can get together a short hair gene, and you get offspring which are shorter hair. Unlike mum and dad, this is what I was saying about the way in which the genes are reorganised in the reproduction. You can get a short hair gene with a long hair gene, just like mum and dad, and you get about 50% of it going to be like that. You get a long hair gene with a long hair gene, what do you get? Long hair one, okay. Okay, which one will be best adapted to cold weather, like living here? I mean really cold weather, really cold weather. Of course, this one, right? Yeah. So after the flood, there's an ice age. After Noah's flood, there's an ice age, one ice age. And at the high latitude areas where there's lots of snow and ice, these ones are going to be much better adapted to survival. So these ones die off, violins play. And these ones fall in love. They don't have much choice, do they? And they have offspring. What sort of offspring can they have? They can only have long hair offspring because they've actually only got the long hair gene now. And so we get a long hair variety of wolf, we call it a different species if you like, and we've lost the gene for short hair. Natural selection actually got rid of the gene for short hair. Mm-hmm. And that's what selection does. It actually selects, it can get rid of this, favour this, but it doesn't create anything. So the basic problem is when they say natural selection is evolution, is it only sorts existing information, fundamental problem. And so they display the Galapagos finches in the textbooks, for example, as being evolution in action, and Charles Darwin wrote about these after his visit to the Galapagos Islands on his trip around the world in the 1830s on the Beagle, and he talked about how, and a lot of research has been done on these since. So they gave them different species names depending on these beak shapes and things, and said, oh, probably some finches got blown across from South America to the Galapagos Islands in a storm, and those finches bred up, and then we got all this speciation occurred, and beaks adapted to different sorts of food, evolved. So we have evolution in action. There you go, evolution's proven. Do you see a problem with the story? Well, the problem is that they're still finches. And variety in beaks does not prove evolution. In fact, I look around here today, I see some variety of beaks here. I don't see any evidence of evolution. So they're still finches. So I don't have a problem with the story about the finches and the adaptation and the natural selection and different foods and different beaks adapt to different sorts of foods, even call them different species if you like. But in the last 50 years, a lot of research has been done on these, and they find that all the different species interbreed. So are they really species to start with? Secondly, just 3 years ago, a major paper was published that looked at the genetics of the beak shapes. And guess what? The genetics for the beak shapes was already present in the population before they actually became what they are today. In other words, God actually put within those creatures the ability to produce different beak shapes so they can adapt to different sorts of food right at the start. There's no evolution at all anyway. So not even a new type of beak appeared through this process. So variety in beaks does not even explain the origin of beaks, let alone the origin of finches, or that finches came from a T-Rex-like creature over 100 million years or something like that. So you see, adaptation, yes. Natural selection, yes. Evolution, no. It's trickery again. And it's like this cartoon. This is the professor at the university. Says, I see evolution happening in my lab. It's a fact. And he's talking about some minor variations in moths or something. And the student thinks he sees this. But he doesn't see that. He just sees those minor variations. It's called, technically called in logic, equivocation, where you actually change the definition of a term mid-sentence and trick people into believing what you're saying. So what can natural selection explain? Hugo de Vries, back in the 1905, said this. Natural selection, this is from Darwin, may explain the survival of the fittest, but it cannot explain the arrival of the fittest. Very perceptive. So the problem is that the information of living things. So you look at us, how much information do we have in our DNA? Well, it's equivalent of how many books, Bible-sized books, do you think, on our DNA? If you wrote out all our DNA information, just for one cell, on our DNA, how many Bible-sized books? It would be 1,000 Bible-sized books of information. So, if bacteria, the simplest bacteria that can live, we talk about one book, that's a lot of information to start with. I mean, how long does it take to read the Bible? We talked about that out the back a while ago. You know, you read just two chapters a day, it's going to take a couple of years to read the Bible. So that's a lot of information just in the bacterium. Where does it come from? Where does the information come from? This is a basic problem. They say that mutations created the information. That's the only mechanism they have. What are they? Well, they're copying mistakes. So where do you get your information from? You got it from your parents. The DNA came from your parents, mum and dad. And in passing the information from mum and dad to you, some mistakes are made. They're called mutations. It's like you're typing on your computer and hit the wrong key. What's that called? A typo. So mutations are typos in our DNA. Right? Anybody ever had a new thought arise by hitting the wrong key? Doesn't happen, does it? So, in the early 1900s, they discovered mutations. This is when Hugo de Vries talked about how natural selection doesn't do what they need. Doesn't explain the arrival of the information. the rival of the fittest, he said, they discovered mutations. I said, oh, here we are. We've got some difference in the fruit fly or something or other through this accidental change. That's the way we've got all the new information for evolution to proceed. And so they embarked on these experiments on Drosophila, you know, the fruit flies. So you've got some rotten fruit and little tiny flies appear. They're called Drosophila. And they're attracted by the fermenting of the fruit. That's why they're called ferment flies. They do no harm. In fact, they help get rid of the rotten fruit. But they're very good for lab experiments because they're easy to breed and you get lots of them and you can zap them with things, you can treat them with chemicals and nobody worries about they're doing that. Poor flies, yeah. And so they embarked on this project of mutating these flies to make them into super flies, improving evolution. What did they find? They ended up with defective flies. And they're known by the defects they have. They have, this is the wild type, the normal one is not defective, but they have bar eyes. So instead of having normal shaped eyes, they've got little tiny eyes, they've got cut wings, they've got rudimentary wings, they've got rotated abdomen. They've got little tiny vestigial wings that can't even fly. They've got curly wings that can't fly, or they fly in a circle. They've got two thoraxes that are one, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so very disappointing. It was very, very disappointing for them because they never found any superflies at all. All they found were defective flies. And it became obvious that mutations are not going to cut it for making all the new information. To put feathers on reptiles, or to put muscles on things that weren't there before, or to create eyes where there were no eyes before, and things. All the things have to be explained by this evolutionary process. But you see, if science fiction reinforces the mythology that mutations can be good things. They can create stuff. Think about all the X-Men stuff. You probably don't even see those, but that's a good thing. All this science fiction, and they've got all these amazing powers through what? Mutations. Aren't they wonderful things? No, mutations cause disease. We have, there's a website, you can Google it, Google for disease and mutations. And there's a website that documents all the human diseases that have been, and the mutations that cause them. There are tens of thousands of mutations that have been identified that cause disease. And you know some of these. I mean, hemochromatosis. I think about 1 in 25 people have hemochromatosis, where you have to minimise your consumption of red meat and iron so you don't get too much iron in your system. It's not a disastrous thing. If you look after yourself, you can live a normal life. But cystic fibrosis you certainly don't want. Haemophilia. Sickle cell anemia, they call it a beneficial mutation. Now, the question is not whether something's beneficial or not. It's the question is whether it's adding something that wasn't there before. And here, it's something new feature. So why is this anemia, why is it beneficial? Or how could it be beneficial? It's a disease. Well, if you happen to live in Africa, where there's malaria, and you have this disease, the malaria parasite doesn't like your misshapen blood cells, and consequently you have some resistance to malaria. Anybody like this beneficial mutation? It's actually a disease. If you have this and you try and run a marathon, you could drop dead from lack of oxygen. So it's a defect in the hemoglobin which results in this sickle cell shaped blood cells, which the malaria parasite doesn't like. It's like, you know, in Ukraine, they want to stop the Russian tanks from coming, right? What do? Blow up the bridges. Beneficial mutation. Right? Beneficial for the war effort, but it's blowing stuff up. That's what this is. Blowing stuff up that happens to be beneficial under certain circumstances. That's what mutations do. Mutations break things. They don't make things. In fact, we're accumulating mutations at such a rate that we're actually decaying genetically. Now, we're getting over 100 new mutations per person per generation. So that means that my grandchildren have 200 new mutations I didn't have. They're not creating us, they're destroying us. In fact, a creationist geneticist by the name of Dr. John Sanford wrote a book about this, and it's about genetic entropy. Now, this is an update to 2025. The previous estimate of 50 to 100 new mutations per generation, a new study, four generations of family, in other words, you've got great-grandparents, grandparents, parents and children, or something like that, four generations, you can actually look at the, nowadays you can actually sequence all their genomes and actually compare them and see how many mutations have been added. It shows 100 to 200 new mutations, not 50 to 100. Per generation, about 75% which are point mutations, just one letter. They showed much higher rates of non-point mutations than they thought. That is where there's a loss or a gain. When you have a loss or a gain, it's much more serious than if you have one substituted. Switch a letter, it doesn't change the whole protein, it just changes one amino acid. But if you have a deletion, the rest of the reading is all out. Or an addition, all the rest of the reading of the gene is all out, so it has a serious effect. So in other words, it's saying there's many more serious mutations than what they thought. They also observed some parts of the genome mutate much faster than others, which say evolution is about being random, supposed to be random. So this is a paper just published, and this makes a very serious problem for any idea we've been around for millions of years. Because as one Russian geneticist said, Alexei Kondrashov, he said, why aren't we dead 100 times over? Because he's got the idea we've been here for a million years. So if we've been here for millions of years, all these generations and all these mutations added, we should be dead. We should be extinct. Well, we haven't been here that long. That's why we're not extinct. But would Adam and Eve have mutations? Would they have any defects? No, of course not. They were made by the hand of God. Adam and Eve were perfect, their genetics were perfect. Do you know, all this points back to perfection in the past, doesn't it? Scientifically, it points back to perfection in the past. And that's what we see in Genesis. God made everything, and it was very good. So we live in a fallen world where God has withdrawn some of his sustaining power, and consequently we're decaying. And when we see the decay, we should say, how bad is sin that's brought about this decay in God's good world? Now, also what's being discovered inside living things, again, I showed you that rotary motor this morning, which runs on a positive current of protons rather than electrons like our electric motors run on electrons. But there's all sorts of other motors in living things. This is an animation of one called Kinnison, down here, Kinnison. It's like the postal service or delivery service. So you order a machinery part from Launceston and you get it delivered, right? This is a delivery service inside the cell. And it walks around, literally walks like this, although actually this is slowed down so you can see it. This walks at metres per second and we're talking about 125,000 steps in a millimetre. So we're talking about real, real fast here. And this is involved in delivering enzymes into your salivary glands so you can digest your lunch. It's involved in thinking, so dumping neurotransmitters into your synapses so you can think. Just think about, you put your finger on a hot plate, how long does it take to work out it's hot and you need to pull your finger away, and you pull your finger away very quickly, right? This all happens when neurotransmitters being dumped with the kinesin. This happens quickly, not slow and gradual like this. But what's happening here is proteins are manufactured, like enzymes are proteins, they're manufactured with an address label on them to say where they'll be taken to, like into the salivary gland, for example, and into your mouth, or into the synapse in your brain, in your neurotransmitters. So, and also involved in cell division. You might have seen the video of cell dividing under a microscope, and all the chromosomes line up in the middle, and they all line up, and then they all pull apart. See that? This kinesins are involved in pulling the chromosomes apart. Life is not possible for us and creatures with a nucleus without these kinesins. Bacteria don't have them. We do. So, just think about it. You need the proteins to be manufactured with an address label. You need to read the address label, package them up in the package, and then the system needs to know where they're packing to and delivers them to their destination. This is the road network of microtubules, a type of protein, and that road network is not fixed. You can imagine driving to Launceston and the road appears in front of you as you drive. That's the style of thing we're talking about here. So can anybody think they could ever have thought of imagine designing this? Like, this is just amazing. It's just gobsmacking amazing. And again, this is experimental science showing an amazing complexity that could only speak of an amazing creator, our creator the Bible talks about, which is our Lord and Saviour. So here's the thing, that neither mutations nor natural selection create the information needed. Evolution is an impossible process. Now, but people say, and you'll get people say, oh, but there's ape men, that proves evolution. Anybody ever had that said to them? There's ape men, you know, there's Neanderthal, all that, da da da. Well, maybe this is our great, 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 great grandmother. Maybe yours, not mine.
Not mine.
Not yours. So I have a short 3-minute documentary here about the ape men. I'm probably going to have to fiddle around a bit here because I forgot to actually set the sound on the projector. Let me see what's happening here. Before I go further, I might check I've got the sound set right. Actually, it has chosen the projector. Clever computer. Here we go. Can you hear that?
So bad that everything in between. But what if I were to tell you that if we're to be honest with...
Sorry, I think I can get it louder.
The evidence that we have, this picture should look more like this. Let me explain. On the left is what is believed to be the first ape, known as Proconsul, and on the right is a human called Homo sapiens. But what scientific evidence is there for everything else in this image? The transitional species. Let's find out. We'll start with Homo neanderthalensis. You might know this Neanderthal man. Recent discoveries have shown that Neanderthal man made or wore jewelry, played instruments, used tools, and wore makeup. We've even found that his brain was the same or slightly larger than the average human living today. In other words, Neanderthal man was actually just a man. What about Homo erectus? Recent discoveries have shown that Homo erectus made tools, engaged in artwork, spoke intelligent language, and made and sold clothes. In other words, Homo erectus was also just a man. Now we'll come back to Homo habilis in a moment, but first, let me show you something. Have you ever heard of Lucy, the most famous so-called ape man, paraded in our museums, one of the very first Australopithecus afarensis species ever to be found? But what does the evidence reveal? She had a skull that was sloped and ape-like, nothing like human skulls, fingers that were curved, not at all like human fingers, toes that were curved, not at all like human toes, wrists that had the ability to lock for knuckle walking, and a knee structure that was compatible with life in trees. So Lucy and her kind swung from trees and looked like today's apes. Lucy is an extinct type of ape. As we've just seen, Homo sapiens, Neanderthal man, and Homo erectus were all men. Australopithecus afarensis and Proconsul were both apes. Considering the ubiquity of the evolutionary icon, we'd really want to see some strong evidence for Homo habilis, the pivotal point of transition between ape and upright man, between basic instinct and intelligent thought, between animal voice and intelligent speech. The only problem is, in the words of Ian Tattersall, Homo habilis is a wastebasket taxon, little more than a convenient recipient for a motley assortment of hominid fossils.
Sorry. Trying to get more volume. Now I've messed it up entirely. Ah! I'm trying to drag it up. Come on. It doesn't want to. It doesn't want to drag up. Oh, come on. Oh, here we go. Trying to go back to here where we were.
You may recognise this image from school textbooks.
No, that's the start. Oh, no.
No.
Now I've got to drag that along. come on.
So diverse and everything in between. But what if I were to tell you that if we're to be honest with the evidence that we have, this picture should look more like this?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I messed it up.
We got it.
Anyway, the bottom line is that there is no evidence for human evolution. And I'll just show you why there will never be any evidence for human evolution. And we've already covered some of it. But you've probably heard of the idea that humans and chimps are supposed to be our common, our closest relative amongst animals. But and they say, oh, we're only 1% difference. Well, actually, it's 1.6% they claim. But it sounds like not much of a difference, but in fact, that's a big difference. 1.6% is a big difference because we have so much information in our DNA. That will be equivalent to 100 paperback-sized books of information. Not a small difference. But here's the rub. That's old idea, old science. It's now known to be 15% different, which is over 900 books. And this is paper this year in Nature. And it was a massive paper, like a 180-page paper, comparing chimps and orangutans and gorillas and etc. Compared to human, and there was a massive paper. They didn't actually spell out that the difference is 15%, because that's a bit, a bit unacceptable. But you can do it yourself. You go and look at the data they published and compare it, and it's a 15% difference. And that is a huge problem for the evolution story. Because even with their best scenarios, they could never even explain 1% difference, let alone 15%. It's just too much. But why would there be similarities with chimps anyway? I mean, it's God trying to make us believe in evolution. Well, no. It's because they had the same designer, and there's a purpose, I believe, in the fact that we are similar. There's two reasons why we're similar to animals, other creatures, and different things. One is that we need to be similar for ecological reasons, because if we were entirely different, what would we eat? There'd be nothing to eat, because we'd be entirely different biochemically. We wouldn't be able to eat the plants and animals and things. We wouldn't be able to consume milk or anything from an animal because we'd be so different. So we've got to be similar. Biochemically, we have to be similar. Secondly, similarity speaks to us of one designer. Think about these two cars, for example. You've got a VW Beetle and a Porsche. This is the original ones, not the modern ones. Why do they have so many similarities? I put the yellow colour so the ladies can see there's some similarity. But so many similarities in the design because they had the same designer. Dr. Porsche was the designer of both vehicles. Now, the interesting thing is, in fact, I understand that not even one component could you actually interchange. But they're nevertheless similarities in the design of the components. And so that's the reason. Now, here's the thing that even with the best possible evolution scenarios, they can't explain even a tiny amount of the difference in a human and chimp. We are clearly created separately. And this is called the waiting time problem. And this goes back like 60 years to an evolutionist by the name of J.B.S. Haldane. And he was an atheist, along with a lot of these famous people in this field. And he came up, the thing was called, ended up being called the Haldane's Dilemma, because he was the one that thought of it. He said, even with the best possible evolutionary scenario of beneficial mutations and natural selection working on the selecting the beneficial mutations and so on, because of the long generation time of humans and chimps, about 20 years, it will take a long time to achieve anything. And in fact, there's not enough time. Even with 7 million years, there's not enough time. And so this is called Haldane's Dilemma. And this has been remodeled today with modern computers and everything. You can actually model this. And this was done by these guys, published in this journal, a secular journal. And they found that even with the best possible scenario, the best possible assumptions about evolution, natural selection, about mutations being beneficial, and about them, everything, they found that it would take to establish a string of just two nucleotides or two letters require an average of 84 million years. That's not two books, it's two letters. 84 million years, that's more than 10 times the time since we're supposed to split off from the chimps, and we get two letters. Making assumptions that, you know, in other words, it's never going to happen. Evolution of chimps from a evolution of humans from a chimp-like ancestor is impossible. So this is real science. This is real experimental science. It shows that evolution of microbes to man is impossible. Not just unlikely, it's impossible. So what about Adam and Eve? Is there any genetic evidence we came from Adam and Eve? There is, actually. This is published in Nature, funnily enough. Nature was established by Thomas Huxley in the 1800s to promote evolution, would you believe? But they gave the game away here. Genetic Adam and Eve did not live too far apart in time. Studies redate Y chromosome Adam and mitochondrial Eve. What's that about in a secular journal? Well, they worked out that if you look at mitochondrial DNA, it's a little loop of DNA within your mitochondria. Mitochondria is where those ATP synthase, that's rotary motor works, they're all in there, where they generate the energy to feel live. But there's a little loop of DNA in there, and that's inherited through your mother. So the egg from your mother has the mitochondria in it. The sperm from the father don't contribute any mitochondria. They just contribute the genetic material. So they're basically all the organelles, the mitochondria come from your mother through the egg. So the mitochondrial DNA comes from your mother. So if you look at the mitochondrial DNA and sequence it all around the world, all the people all around the world,